had two other names that sort of came to me while we were talking of the day or looking at your records. Virgil Buckelhide did some work with you at one time.
He worked on the animal area program with me at Illinois as a postdoc.
Okay. Did you mention knowing Frank Westheimer when you were at
sure.
Harvard?
We were very, we're still very good friends.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't. I
know Frank
that.
Very well. Know his wife. So we still exchange Christmas cards, and okay. we've had many discussions of chemistry. And I guess one of the guys I really have enjoyed discussing chemistry with as much as anybody is Linus Pauling. We had many very interesting discussions. It always amused me immensely that Linus and I never had any serious disagreements. It was only his disciples who considered me a heretic. Linus, I could tell him what I was thinking about and he would agree completely, you know. He had no problems with the way I was thinking about things at all. Well, he knew the limitations of resonance theory, that it wasn't the be-all, end-all for everything, and he understood the electrical effects, but his disciples, like Wieland and Wernstein, those were the people that I really had problems with. That always kind of amused me. So Linus and I are still good friends, and of course we've shared not only interest in trying to understand the structure and reactivity of chemicals, but our efforts for peace.
Yes. At the time you did the war work, how did you justify that to yourself? Yours was not a...
What I was doing was, as I think you can see...
Yeah, it was sort of a protective kind of, yes, it was very constructive.
Trying to cure malaria and trying to take toxic stuff out of water,
yes.
I didn't have
okay.
any problems
yeah.
with. And besides, I wasn't a, you know, I'm a Quaker and I have a strong interest in trying to work for peace, but I'm not an absolute pacifist. And, you know, I recognize the need for police force, justifying. In support of community interests, what I oppose is the use of force and self-interest, which I think is what war is. So I never had any serious difficulties with that. I guess I could have wondered if I had been pushed to do work more directly related to the destructive ends. The closest I got to that was an effort collaborating with Bob Poussin on agents that would be water denial agents. And agents that would not be toxic, but would be so stinking or unpleasant that if you put them in a well, nobody would drink the water. I guess this was necessary, or they thought it was necessary in the North African campaigns where wells were one of the most crucial natural resources. And they were going to have to retreat. They thought, well, rather poisoning the well, they might just put something in that would make it so unpleasant that nobody would drink the water. But that's about as close as I came to having to work on things which were... I mean, of course, in chemical warfare, I was working on extremely toxic things, but we were working on how to detoxify
yes.
them.
Yes. Yeah, I noticed that, and I thought, gee, that fit in very nicely with the work, with your Quaker upbringing, and as well as your later work. We talked a little bit about the Notre Dame Conference, and you told me some of the ideas. Can you recall anything else about its organization? You knew you were going to Notre Dame at that point, obviously, when you got the idea. It was a sort of a great way to start your career there.
I guess I thought it would be a very good way to kind of put Notre Dame on the map a little bit more and put it a little bit front and center. But I must say, I don't remember. There probably was some kind of a committee that was put together to plan the program. But I haven't the vaguest idea who else would be. I just have no idea.
Okay.
It's terrible.
you've made a number of contributions to theoretical organic chemistry, and you've also spent some time in synthesis and structure determination. Did you ever feel that these two aspects of your career were somehow separate, scientific, or were you an organic chemist who looked at a variety of problems?
I certainly thought they were separate, yes. I didn't think there was any intimate connection.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I did quite as much conscious thinking about mechanisms for synthesis as, say, Bob Woodward did. With Bob, those two things were very closely put together. He liked to think about synthesis in terms of using mechanisms as an approach to mm-hmm. devising these
right.
synthetic approaches.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I was ever quite that conscious about it, although whenever I saw or talked about any reaction, I always liked to think about the mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Might give you just a little anecdote about that. When I was going to the Gordon conferences down in, and they were still held at Gibson Island, this must have been right after the war, 46 or 47. On the train on the way out, I read a paper by Herman Brusen of Brusen, Roman Haas, on the addition of HX compounds to dicyclopentadiene. That norbornene type double bond is very reactive. That's what's involved in this patent case I'm involved in down at Wilmington, incidentally. But this was addition of HX to the double bond, and it added all kinds of compounds. Added easily, I guess Brusen had a dozen patents on this area, with thousands and thousands of compounds that he made by addition of HX to dicyclopentadiene. And he proved that there was a carbon skeleton rearrangement. And he postulated what the product structure of the product was, or the rearranged product. And I sat down with a pencil to see if it fit with the normal carbonium ion mechanism, and it didn't. There was no way he could have gotten the products that he claimed he got.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sketched out what I thought the product ought to be. And when I got to the conference, it turns out Paul Bartlett was assigned as my roommate. So I showed Paul what I had gone through, and he said, gee, that looks very reasonable. I'm working on dicyclopentadiene. Let me try it. So within a few weeks, Paul Bartlett had proven that all of Brusen's compounds were incorrectly assigned. And, you know, I arrived at that conclusion based on the mechanism, and it turned out that I was right. Paul Bartlett published it in a little note a few months later. So I always, and every time I look at a chemical reaction, I like to try to see if I can imagine what the mechanism of the reaction is.
Yeah.
That's just an almost automatic reflex act. But I don't think it was as consciously planned that way as I think Bob Woodward likes to give the impression. I don't know whether that's true of Bob, but that's certainly the impression he likes to give.
Yeah. I think most people think in terms of his work is like that. And, let's see, he hadn't come to Harvard when you were there. Was he at Illinois when you got out there?
Yes, he spent the summer. The first summer we were there, let's see, that would be the summer of 37. Bob had just gotten through MIT in 5 years from the time he was a freshman. He was invited out to be an instructor in summer school in Illinois.
He didn't fit in well with the
other. He did not win friends and influence people in Illinois, I'll tell you. I've later gotten to feel like Bob and I are very good friends, but he was a very brash and egotistical young mm-hmm. man at that point. And he thought he'd really come out to the boondocks of Illinois. You know? And he was very condescending about it.
Uh-huh.
He couldn't get to, was assigned an 8 o'clock class, well, of course, in Cambridge, they don't have 8 o'clock classes. He just never got there on time, and he was supposed to be supervising a lab, and he was very seldom there. And he played poker with Speed and a couple of guys, and then never paid off his debts. And he just antagonized people right and left. So he was always coming. Harold Snyder and I were still lab mates and postdocs to Roger Adams that summer. I didn't start teaching in that fall. And Bob had the office next to us, and he spent a lot of time in our place bumming cigarettes from Harold Slade. And Harold finally figured out the answer to that. He kept the cigarettes in, hidden in a drawer, and he kept the pack on the desk with just one cigarette in it. Bob would come in and shake it and look at me. He didn't quite have the nerve to take the cigarette. that did influence Bob's career. He never got the ACS Award in pure chemistry, and that was a gross miscarriage of justice. Uh-huh. But Illinois Profs had a big influence in the ACS, and they just could not stomach this guy. That's when he first came out here. Now, Bob, once he got the Nobel Prize and a few things began to fall in place, were mellowed greatly, and he's a fine guy, and I always enjoy talking to Bob now, and we've had a lot of fun together. But that first summer he taught at Illinois was a rather bit of a disaster.
And he just stayed out there for that short period. I had someone else said something to me about the fact that he didn't win Friends Influence with Bob there, and the worst thing he said was that he borrowed glassware and didn't wash it, but that may have just been enough.
probably that's true too. I think Speed got so incensed that he didn't pay his poker debts that Speed wrote back to whoever it was, the prof at MIT, and said, "What kind of a guy did you send out to us?" And I think the prof got after him and made him pay up his debts. Well, he just was a very brash, ego-centered young man.
I'm hoping that he's sufficiently mild that one of these days he'll be willing to talk to me. I haven't even asked him.
He's a fine guy now, no problem.
When I was a graduate student, he spent 2 hours describing possible research problems to me one afternoon.
Any problems with Bob now?
And he's obviously, at first I thought, gee, he's off in synthesis, but now he becomes a really important figure. The fact that he was one of those transition figures that took physical organic chemistry and applied it to synthesis in the way he did, and made a big difference. In recent years, you've sort of edged into biochemistry and your work on alkylations, proteins, nucleic acids. Can you tell me a little bit about it? How did you get into that work?
Well, that was a direct outcome of both of my wartime projects, as a matter of fact. When I came to Penn, one of the men in the medical school had been a doctor who had been responsible for testing our antimalarial drugs candidates at the Illinois State Prison. Buck Jones. I can't even remember his proper initials, but Buck Jones was an MD in our medical school. He had been in the Illinois prison, had been related to a big project there for the testing of our antimalarial drugs on prison volunteers during the war. And I'd worked with him closely, and when I came here, he immediately came over to see me and said he had a bright idea about a drug for cancer. He knew that the attack of a nucleic acid was a key facet of cancer chemotherapy, and he also knew that the antimalarial drugs that intercalated in the DNA chain, that was how they exerted their antimalarial activity. So his idea was, why don't we take the antimalarial drug, which we know has a preference to going to these chains, and put an alkylating agent on the end of it. All those antimalarial drugs, and most of them had a diethyl amino group at the end of the chain. All you had to do was put two chlorines out there, and you came out with a drug which looked exactly like an antimalarial drug, except it was a nitrogen mustard at the end. And so we made a whole lot of antimalarial mustards. Quinacrin, the 7-chloroquinoline, and a whole host of others. And they actually were extremely interesting antimalarial cancer drugs. Buck Jones actually got to testing one of them. I forget what it was, quinacrin or the 7-chloroquinoline, clinically, because it had been extremely effective in mice and rats. And actually, in his clinical tests, it was extremely effective in humans. But a number of them got the most weird, psychotic experiences out of this drug. After they were given it, but it was just scrubbed right out of the program for humans. So his idea actually worked, and it wasn't extremely effective. It was probably one of the most potent of all the mustards for treating cancer. And so we went on and made, I guess by the time we were done, we'd made 500 or 600 compounds here, both modified mustards of all kinds and other antimetabolites. We also got into making other heterocyclic antimetabolites. And after, I don't know, 5 years of making compounds and testing them and finding that most of them were much better than nitrogen mustard, I began to get discouraged about the synthetic approach and then decided it would be interesting to take the mechanistic approach, try to see if we could determine quantitatively what happened when they operated in this reactor with nucleic acids. And so we started out measuring the rates of reaction of adenine, guanine, cytosine, thymine, and nitrogen mustard, and then put the sugar on and put the phosphate on and strung them together, homopolymers. And it was in this work, incidentally, that we got involved with using the diethyl chloroethyl compound, because for analytical reasons, it would be far simpler to look at a monofunctional alkylating agent rather than a difunctional alkylating agent, where you have a sequence of two reactions that have different rates and just get much more complicated. So we decided to shift to diethyl chloroethyl, I mean, as the nitrogen mustard. And I still remember the student, this was an Indian student, was going to start this work with me. I told him to just put the mustard in, hydrochloride in, neutralize it to pH 7, and let it cyclize, and then use it as a cyclizing mustard. And he came back and said it didn't cyclize. I said, go back and do it again. Back and did it again, and he came back and didn't cyclize, Doc. And so all of a sudden it dawned on me that the dichloroethyl mustard, the chlorine, lowers the pK of the base to about 7 or 6, so that at pH 7 it's mostly deprotonated. So I checked and the pK of diethyl chloroethyl is 10. pH 7 is only a 0.1% of it deprotonated. All we had to do was move to pH 10 and cyclize almost instantly, and then that gave us a stable reagent. We then backed it down to pH 7 and used it for our alkylation. So most of our alkylation studies were used on using diethyl ethylene ammoniumide. That's the alkylating agent, actually. It reacted readily with nucleophiles. Disulfide was the way we titrated it. And it reacted with the nucleophilic centers. We proved that where it went on the different nucleophiles, guanine, cytosine, adenine, and so on. And the one thing, the only thing, I guess, that we really discovered out of all this, which I still think is pretty interesting and important. It had been reported already in the literature that when DNA was in a double helix, adenine didn't alkylate, because the nucleophilic center of adenosine is the one that's hydrogen bonded. The guanine was open, and it was known qualitatively that you get 7-alkyl guanine. What wasn't known was that it was 50,000 times as reactive as it is in ordinary guanine. 20,000, I forget, some fantastic number, enhanced reactivity, which of course explains why DNA is a selective target for nitrogen mustard, when it has such an extremely highly enhanced nucleophilicity. So we explained it, the reactivity, and it was only true in double helix DNA. Like a random coil, the reactivity drops way down. Double helix structure.
I see. And it probably just exposes the nucleophilic center in certain ways?
I think that was the main reason. The hypothesis that we proposed, Leon, was that this made a very effective way of distributing the charge that you're going to put on the whenever this is from my old electrostatic days, whenever you have a charge on a small body, it's much more higher energy than if you could put that same charge in a big body. The potential energy of X charge on a big body is a lot lower than X charge on a small body. So anything you can do to distribute charge automatically lowers the energy. And of course, the fact that it's hydrogen bonded means that you can shift the proton more over to the nose to distribute more charge to the other chain.
Right.
But the fact that they're also pi bonded means that the electrons in the base above and below could shift into that ring.
Mm-hmm.
That means these two bases with more plus charge.
Mm-hmm.
When you put some plus over here, they can. So you distribute the charge over a whole segment of the chain by both nose-to-nose proton sharing and cheek-to-cheek electron sharing.
Right.
And, so that was our explanation, that you've lowered the potential energy of the product very greatly, and that lowers the potential energy of the transition state. That's what we thought. Of course, it is exposed, but...
No, but in the case of the guanine, you said in the double helix, that reacted far faster than...
Yeah. Than the ordinary guanine, where it doesn't have these mechanisms to exchange, to spread the charge. Then the guanine is going to have a plus charge on a guanine molecule. If you alkylate guanine or guanosine or monomer.
Oh, I see. In the final product you're talking about, you can distribute the charge, rather than...
That also happens in the transition state.
Okay.
The charge is not going to be on a single guanine molecule, it's going to be...
Right, because you're lowering... Yes.
To its two neighbors above and below, and to its neighbor in the adjacent chain.
Okay, so you lower the transition state considerably by stabilizing the product, right?
And we show the guanine cytosine pair. You make poly G and poly C. You get a greatly activated G.
I see.
And so it is the pair. We did that for the synthetic as well as for the natural.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite an extensive paper that we finally published on that, because we had to do all this groundwork to build up to that.
Yeah.
So it was a hell of a lot of work to prove that one fact.
Yeah, but
and that was the only surprise and the only interesting feature of the work that really came out. And was a quantitatively much greater work to it. Then we started to do that for proteins, trying to see if the particular structure, to take proteins of known structure, three-dimensional structure, so you knew who responded to what,
and
see if we could come out with any similar observations. Well, we just barely got started on that. We published one paper on that when my antimalarial work was terminated. The same year, my thiobenzene program was terminated, and that was one of the deciding factors that made me think maybe I could do something more interesting and useful in some of the field of chemistry. People would think what I was doing was worthwhile. I just finally gave up the struggle.
How did you your writing on evolution and the synthesis of life begin? Was that an outgrowth of some of the researches, or is that?
Some of this, certainly this work on DNA and protein has been very helpful, giving me a background on that. But that started in an entirely different way. Maybe you don't recall, when I was president of the ACS in 1965, one of the few functions that the president has is to give a presidential address. And I wanted to do something that I hoped would be significant, an opportunity that doesn't repeat very often. And so in addition to starting, I did two things as president of the ACS that I get some significance. The other one was the starting the chemistry and public affairs activities of the society. But I, on my presidential address, I had heard so often chemists saying, gee, everything that's interesting and exciting has already been done. You know, what is there left to do in chemistry? And so I thought I'd kind of stick a needle into that feeling by talking about the synthesis of life, which hadn't been done, and was a pretty exciting prospect. And there were all kinds of reasons why it would be very exciting and interesting and significant. I think I said in my talk that it would probably even more significant in the long run than the discovery of atomic energy. So that talk attracted a lot of attention. There was some favorable and some very unfavorable.
Mm-hmm. I expect.
As a matter of fact, 6 weeks after my talk, Saul Spiegelman reported on the synthesis of RNA viruses in a test tube. Really remarkable work. And referred to my talk in his paper and said, oh no, so I predicted it might take 20 years to do this. He says it only took 6 weeks. Saul had done a beautiful job. He got to thinking about how could an RNA virus, work in a cell? Why does the RNA virus replicate at the expense of all the other RNAs that are synthesized? I mean, there are all kinds of RNA replicases going on in the cell. When an RNA virus invades the cell, most of the RNA that's synthesized is new virus. And it's, it kind of turns that on and turns off a lot of the regulars. So he got the idea that an RNA virus might have in it carried the information to the ribosome.
Messenger.
Messenger. That part of the RNA virus was a messenger that went to the ribosome and instructed it to synthesize a protein, which was a very specific enzyme for replicating only that RNA virus. So you began to turn on a special machinery that only replicated virus. Ordinary RNA replicase will replicate any RNA.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to replicate any. So he thought maybe this was a specific enzyme that replicated only the virus, and he looked at it at virus-infected one-celled organisms, and found out, by golly, they did have an extra enzyme in them, and it did exactly that. And so he isolated that enzyme, put it in a test tube, along with a few virus molecules and a lot of triphosphates, ATP, GTP, CTP, and UTP, UTP for RNA. And by golly, it just started replicating virus. So he was synthesizing virus in a test tube.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he synthesized life or not depends on whether you call a virus life.
Right.
But anyhow, that's how I got started in it. And having started it, I got more and more interested in it, and have followed it very carefully. And it integrated into my concern about society in a very interesting way. And I guess very shortly after I gave that ACS talk, I began talking about, writing articles about the relation of order to evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And the latest book I have just a manuscript for has been on is The Societal and Philosophical Consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And the book on the synthesis of life was actually written as a prelude to this later book, both to get me tooled up on the scientific facts, but also to establish my credentials to write about this.
This was, are you talking about the Benchmarks book?
Scientific book, which is a prelude to a book on the societal and philosophical consequences. But it all got started for me in that ACS talk, and it was kind of a really remarkable happenstance that that field has so closely come to be integrated with my concern for world order.
Mm-hmm.
The principles just flow from one to the other, I think.
Yeah.
It's remarkable applicability.
Yeah. It's,
And certainly the work we did on PNIS.